Hello and welcome. My conversation today is with Derek Jensen, an author, eco-philosopher, and environmentalist. Derek has been described by Democracy Now! As the poet-philosopher of the ecological movement. He's written books that are known as much for their breadth of knowledge as their originality of thought. His works are sometimes misconstrued and a lightning rod within the historically people-centric mainstream ecological community. Jensen is the prize-winning author of A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, Listening to the Land, Strangely Like War, and the upcoming Bright Green Lies. He was one of two finalists for the 2003 J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize, which cited The Culture of Make-Believe as, quote, a passionate and provocative meditation on the nexus of racism, genocide, environmental destruction, and corporate malfeasance, where civilization meets its discontents. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Audubon, and The Sun, among many others. Our following conversation is freeform. Throughout, we push forward and double back on ideas, interspersed with thoughts and threads pulled from personal experience, literary influences, and baseless yet entertaining conjecture. Some of the subject matter can be challenging to our idea of ourselves, and hopefully our conversation helps stoke the embers within you that helps you question your own responsibility towards the planet in the future as well as the present. And now, Derek Jensen. Do you have anything coming out right now?
Yeah, I got a book coming out in a couple weeks called Bright Green Lies that is about how wind and solar not only are not going to save us or the planet, but they're actually pretty harmful. And there has been a horrible transformation has taken place in the environmental movement over the past 30 years that at one point the environmental movement was about saving wild places and wild beings, but it's been transformed into being about perpetuating this culture. So you can have environmentalists or people who call themselves environmentalists saying it's a great idea to build a huge artificial island off the coast of Denmark to put in wind energy turbines. And if you ask the fish, if you ask the ocean, if you ask the ocean currents, if you ask the seabirds, I don't think they would agree it's a good idea.
We're creating solutions that we want. We're creating solutions for our own problems. We're only thinking within our own frame of perpetuating our need for more energy without any consideration for the detriments that that's going to cause.
Yeah, well, there's a great line by George Monbiot about how basically he asked, how are we going to get the energy that we need to run our brick factories? And it's a great line because it shows what's wrong with the environmental movement for the most part, which is his use of the word are and his worst of the word use of the word we. And how different is it if we change it to how are the capitalists going to get the energy they need to run their brick factories?
Right.
But if you identify with them, it's like, well, that's a good question. How are we going to get it? But we don't need it. The world doesn't need it. And if you, I mean, this is a fundamental problem that the has been at the core of the destruction of the environmental movement is the identification with the system. I mean, so many climate change activists, I mean, a lot of people publicly call Bill McKibben, you know, one of the most important environmentalists of the last 30 years. And he states explicitly that what he's attempting to save is civilization. He doesn't say he's saving, he and I had an exchange about this, that it was very, very interesting that he sent me an email several years ago saying, I've heard you've been saying bad things about me behind my back, and I would hope you'd have the respect for me that if you're going to say something bad about me, you would say it to my face and we could discuss it. And I said, great. Yeah, I'm happy to. And I actually don't say anything bad about you. I think there has been no one who has worked more tirelessly to raise awareness about global warming. I mean, it's absolutely true. He's worked tirelessly and selflessly to do that. I said, my problem is, I've said this in public, that you say explicitly that you want to save civilization. You don't say you want to save icebergs. You don't say you want to save the birds. You don't say you want to save the hillsides. You say again and again and again that you're trying to save civilization, but civilization's killing the planet. And
the tyranny is in our language. The tyranny is in the way that we describe with our words.
And the language in this case, and not just the case of him, but in the case of people in general, the language accurately describes their loyalty. And most people in this culture perceive civilization, it is easier for them to imagine the death of the oceans or the death of the planet than it is for them to imagine the end of this way of life.
Yes.
But my work is actually pretty simple. I can sum up all of my work in one or two sentences, which is, or are, this way of life will not last forever, semicolon. And when it's done, I would prefer that there be more of the world left rather than less. That's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that this is starting to go a bit afield, but something a lot of people, I don't know if I've made clear enough, but I fundamentally come at this fundamentally from a conservative perspective, by which I don't mean socially conservative. What I mean is, I think it's really, really, really stupid to wipe out salmon that you might want to eat tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's a remarkably, I don't think there is anything one could do that could be more stupid.
You touch on something that very much, Slavoj Žižek.
What in yourself?
Do you know Slavoj Žižek?
I know the name, but I've never read anything.
He likes to analyze films. And his thing is, quite consistently, that it's easier for people to consider and think about the end of the world instead of changing the system. It's so unimaginable to get outside of the framework of the system that all we can do is continue creating these stories where the world comes to an end over and over again because we haven't broken past to the alternative, to the next, to solving the problem. We're stuck in some sort of liminal state between what we have an inkling of needing to do and being able to do it.
There's a couple directions that this takes me immediately. One of them is one of my best friends is a doctor who his specialty is he's an internist, by which he means he deals with systems. And he worked for years hospice at the VA, and he would deal with people undergoing system failure, multi-system failure. So, for example, people end-stage emphysema. And what he found is that a lot of people would find it easier to imagine their own death from emphysema than quitting smoking cigarettes.
Are these always framing issues?
So it is partly framing, yes. And I want to go a couple directions with this, and then I want to come back to how it's not framing. One way it is framing is, I love this line by, I believe it was Robert Coombs or something, said, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And that has to do with this framing. And, you know, earlier I said, you know, how Mambio framed the question as, how do we get the energy we need to run our brick factories? So that is definitely framing. And decades ago now, I read a really good book by Frederick Turner, who wrote Beyond Geography. And that book is really about how Christianity is a linear religion. And if you have a linear religion, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Revelation, you know, the Christian idea ends with the end of the world.
Yes.
And
we're always moving to the end.
Yeah. And if you have a cyclical religion, you have an individual end. Obviously, I'm going to die, and hate to break it to you, but you're going to die too. And I know there's all that. I know. Okay. So anyway, if you have a cyclical religion, it's not based on an end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
There is the individual death, but society is based on cycles, and it's based on the idea of staying in place for thousands and thousands of years. forever, maybe. Yeah. And so that's how it is framing. A way it's not just framing is that one reason that we perceive this way of life, civilization, industrial civilization, whatever you want to call it, as more important than life on the planet is because individually to us and to our own lives, it is. And the reason that it is because if your experience, not your head, not your heart, if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, mm-hmm. you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it.
Absolutely. It's kind of a hostage situation.
It's exactly a hostage situation. It's very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, that means people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency. If, on the other hand, you have a lot of people and not much land, like in a city, then people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to work for you for whatever pittance you want to pay them.
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons for the laws of apartheid. They were written mm-hmm. not out of, I mean, yeah, they were racist. I'm not saying they weren't, but they were written because they needed workers for their mines. And the local mm-hmm. people were living in subsistence villages. And so what they did is they passed poll taxes, hut taxes, dog taxes to pull them into the wage economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not, this is a not past tense. In Wisconsin, we are currently in the midst of an apartheid state.
I was going to ask earlier where you were from, because speaking of self-sufficiency, 200 years ago, people in Wisconsin could have eaten passenger pigeons. And you've got enough food for as long as you want. And absolutely. Why would somebody go to the grocery store if you can walk outside? Or they would literally close their eyes, look up in the air and shoot, and there would be 15 birds fall. That's how thick they were in their flocks.
Yeah.
So if you can go outside, close your eyes, and get dinner for 15 people, mm-hmm. why are you going to go to the grocery store? So it's not just framing. It's also physical conditions.
Absolutely. I mean, from my personal experience, I'm blessed enough to live in northern Wisconsin. I'm adjacent to the Lac du Flambeau Native American Reservation. Their way of life, getting to observe and understand it in a more direct perspective, has allowed me the frame of reference to turn back to my culture and be able to critique it a lot better. We talked about time briefly and how we think in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it's this linear thing. So we're only moving towards the end. We're fatalistic in that right. sense, and that's all we can imagine. The Ojibwe, for example, they understand that there are multiple different levels to time. And the linear level does absolutely exist, mm-hmm. but you also have to give credence to the fact that the cyclical aspects are there, and they have they're an undergirding to your ability to live in linear time as an individual. And things come back, and things that haven't happened are going to happen, and things that did happen have already happened, etc. And to be able to be malleable enough to understand your interconnectedness in that. And I also believe the tyranny is in our language, because in Ojibwe, one way to delineate things in their language is whether it possesses a soul or does not. Okay. So if it ends with a GA, that means it's imbued with a soul. So if you're talking about a deer, it has a soul. If you're talking about my pen, no soul. But the metal of my pen, different word that has a soul. We're so divorced from nature that we don't understand that it's living any longer. We cannot read that it is alive.
I'm going to go off in another direction for a second, that I have a book at the publisher right now about how marijuana legalization is actually a disaster for family farmers and has been a massive transfer of wealth away from family farmers and to the already rich. And right. It mirrors what happened with organic farming in the 90s, what happened with family farming all through the 50s. And I wrote it with a friend of mine who's a marijuana policy guy. And before we started the book, he said, Derek, do not go into an evolutionary history of cannabis. It's like, I want this to be focused. And I couldn't help myself. I thought it was so interesting. How did this plant, okay, the plant evolved way before we did, 36 million years ago. What I thought was really interesting that I went off on for about 20 pages was the endocannabinoid system is, I think, 200 million years old. And every animal has an internal cannabinoid system except for insects and crustaceans. And it's only called a cannabinoid system is because they were studying, it has nothing to do with cannabis. They were studying cannabis when they discovered the endocannabinoid system. That's why it's called that. At first, when I started writing about the evolution of cannabis, I was thinking, wow, it's amazing that we evolved a system that is receptive to this chemical in the plant, but that's not true because the cannabinoid system evolved 170 million years before cannabis. What's a miracle and what's really cool is that cannabis evolved something to which our endocannabinoid system responds. That's the other direction.
Yeah.
And why did they do that? And nobody's really sure why cannabis evolved to deliver cannabinoids to various animals. I have a theory, which I do in the book, which I think is really fun. I'm totally making this up. The idea is that marijuana makes you feel good. And so you get a lot of creatures like squirrels or various rodents will collect acorns, for example, and they will hide them. And that's how the forest propagates because they forget where about 25% of them are. So cannabis puts out tons of seeds, which are pretty high in nutrients and they want to eat them. So here's my thought, which I'm just, again, totally making up. Maybe it evolved it in part because then the seeds would make the creatures who eat them feel good, but it would also make them forgetful. So they want to collect a lot of the seeds, but then they forget where they put a lot of them. And so
it's our ecological propagation tool.
Oh, which by the way is exactly what humans have been doing with cannabis for the last 20,000 years.
I think plants find us. I think that we have a much more nuanced relationship than we are aware of on our surface level consciousness. I think that nature sometimes moves us around like little pawns. It gets its psychic tendrils around you and has you do its bidding for it as a mobile entity.
I completely agree. In fact, years ago, I was interviewing Vine Deloria, and one of the things that he talked about was how different groups from different parts of the world would have radically different dream cosmologies. And especially the people who would live in heavily forested areas would often have cosmologies that were based on how do you maintain psychic integrity as you have all of these various plant beings and sort of jumping into you. And especially in dream, but how do you, as you're walking through this incredibly lush area, you know, you'll be, if you're constantly having all the plants talking to you, and how do you sort of maintain,
forfeit yourself to it? How do you remain yourself?
Yeah.
I don't think that we are personally. When you're embedded in that, if you're spending long amounts of time in it, if you're getting into that process, I think that it's almost a welcome, I don't know, from the perspective of a mainstream intrusion to dissolve yourself more into it. And I think it's totally unnatural for us to act like we are these individual entities divorced from the rest of it because we're literally just killing ourselves over and over again because there is no differentiation. We only want to feel special. We, you know, most of our body is not our DNA.
Yep, I completely agree. I used to think that I was a peripatetic writer, by which I mean that if I get stuck, I take a walk and the act of walking would free stuff up. But I had ideas come to me often enough at specific places in the walk that I realized that, or I surmised is a better word, I guess, that it was actually certain trees who were saying the things to me. Or another way of this, I just love this. So I'm in my mom's house. My mom died 2.5 years ago. I moved into her house. For the last 20 years before that, I lived down 3/8 of a mile through the forest in a cabin, and mm-hmm. I would come up every evening and hang out with my mom, and you know, I took care of her as in her later years. When I would go on tour and then I would get home, I'd hang out with my mom for a little while, and then I would start walking down through the forest to my house, and there was a specific place in the forest that every time, that's when I would feel like I'd gotten home. And at first I thought it was the view, you know, in the path, a specific view would suddenly make me feel. And then I realized, actually when I was writing the cannabis book, I realized that's not it. What it is it's when I have been here and been walking in the forest long enough for the molecules of plant chemicals to have gotten into my lungs and into my bloodstream and crossed the blood-brain barrier. And it would take, that's why it was always the same place, is because it's when I've walked, it's a 1/4 mile. That was how long it would take for it to come into me, get in the blood, cross the blood-brain barrier, and it's like, that's the feeling.
That's a very interesting physiological idea of how that happens.
I'm not discounting spirituality too, of course.
I think that we externalize a lot of our memory and we don't think about that. Like, we don't realize that sometimes we house our memories in an object that's outside of ourselves.
Completely agree with you.
So if you're back in your old neighborhood for the first time in 20 years and you see that one specific thing, you left that there, you know.
I completely agree with you.
We lose a lot, you know, traveling down the same roads every day or seeing the same things every day. And we are the diversity that we allow ourselves to take in around us too, which maybe we should go back to identifying what a city is for you, because I think that yours has been a great definition for me to come across when it comes to how can we expect people within a city to be able to change their behavior when the very thing itself is such an unnatural entity, and what is that entity?
Well, that came up because I was writing my book Endgame, and at that point I'd been bashing civilization for many years, and I thought if I'm going to bash it, I probably better define it. So I looked up in the dictionary, and the definitions were just ridiculous. They were like an advanced state of culture. And I was like, well, that certainly is self-congratulatory. Or the best one was the highest state of culture. Interesting that we define that way ourselves.
We're wonderful.
Yeah, we're wonderful. Anyway, so that's really squishy. So I thought, okay, let's do a more rigorous definition. So civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that is defensible both linguistically and historically. That's when we talk about the rise of civilizations, we're really talking about the rise of cities. And it's defensible linguistically because civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means state or city. So it's right there. Okay, that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So I defined a city as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And that's defensible too. And that shows the difference between a city and a village, a camp, you know, some sort of small community. And a couple things happen as soon as you have, as soon as you require the importation of resources. Require being the key word, by the way, because right. as soon as you require the importation of resources, a few things happen. One is your way of life can never be sustainable. And the reason is because if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll have to denude an ever larger area. And by the way, I think you and I are both going to disagree with the word resource, because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And so many indigenous people have said to me, the most fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. Mm-hmm. So if I look at a tree, there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills.
Mm-hmm.
If when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them differently. If when you look at this particular tree, you'll treat it differently still. Same with salmon. If you see money to be made in the stream, you're going to treat them one way. If you see salmon whose lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me, going to treat them. Doesn't mean you can't eat any salmon, but it means you got a fundamentally different relationship with them. Anyway, mm-hmm. so as soon as you require the importation of resources, one, your way of living can never be sustainable because you've denuded the landscape. And here's something we don't understand. We perceive evolution as consisting of basically who can exploit the most. And we simply exploit the best, which is why we're on top for a few years.
Right. We offshore it right now, so we're pretty happy about it.
Right.
Exactly. We're doing pretty good because we don't see it, because we're in our little, shitty utopia where we exactly. just take it out on everybody else, and then they come to our doorsteps, and then we try and put up a fence.
Yes. Okay, so I can disprove that it's based on hyper-exploiting your surroundings in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons, and they are... those creatures have survived in the long run, You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by improving your habitat. And that's what salmon do. That doesn't mean there isn't any competition. That doesn't mean that the weak salmon don't survive as well. Mm-hmm. It's a combination, but it's also competition within the context of improving your habitat. Because if you hurt your habitat even a little bit, and you keep, as a community, not as an individual, as a community, if you harm your habitat a little bit, and the next generation a little bit, and a little bit, eventually you get down to zero. 100 minus 1 is 99, then 98, then 97, eventually you get to zero. And how do we think the world got to be so rich and fecund in the first place? It's through everybody living and dying and making the world a better place by their births and deaths. It's like, there's a bazillion bears here. I see bears all the time. And bears kill a lot of trees. They like to strip the bark and eat the, I don't remember what it's called, but the inner bark is evidently fairly sweet. I asked a friend of mine who's a biologist working for the Forest Service, so how does that actually serve the forest? And he said he just made this up at the time. This might not be defensible, but I liked his idea, which is he said he lives in a mixed Doug fir tan oak, I think it is, forest. And Doug firs reproduce faster, they reproduce more, they grow faster, they have pretty much every advantage over the oaks, except that bears like to eat the bark. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that happens is bears maintain the Doug fir tan oak combo mm-hmm. by killing some of the Doug firs. I don't know, it makes sense on a superficial level. Anyway, the point is that if you're denuding the landscape of resources, of communities, that means you're harming the landscape, which means you can never be sustainable. And as your city grows, you have to go for an ever larger area, which is the history of civilization right there. As it gets bigger and bigger, it has to take from more and more of the world until the oceans are, stolid scientists are saying the oceans could be devoid of fish within 40 years, 30 years now. Anyway, the other thing it means is your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if you require them and the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for them, you're going to take them because you require them, which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas and it wouldn't matter personally, individually, the United States military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to the oil, the lithium, the whatever else they need? How else are we going to get the energy we need to run our brick factories?
Yeah, anything that's a dollar sign becomes itified,
yeah,
objectified in some capacity, right. and that leads its way to violence, and we've been in that for
6,000 years, 10,000 years.
Yeah, a few thousand years at this point, since the last ice age put the stops to us, and then we pop back up again out of our little torpor to mold the bread of the world, which I think that we're at again, and we're probably going through another cycle. So what is going to happen? We just destroy it, we take ourselves out, it replenishes itself, and then we start the entire thing back over again. We change our behavior. People aren't going to change their behavior voluntarily.
I'll take on the easy one first. The easy one is that when this all comes down, presuming humans continue to exist, there will never be another civilization like this, because the easily accessible reserves, there'll never be another Bronze Age. The easily accessible reserves are gone. There'll never be another Oil Age, because the easily accessible reserves are gone. So this is a one-time blowout. Thank goodness. Sure, there will be, if humans continue, there will certainly be local warlords, and there will certainly be local badness. People aren't going to suddenly behave better, because we know what happens when patriarchal civic society collapses. Mm-hmm. Things are going to get worse before they get worse. And are we going to change? I don't see it, for a few reasons. One of them is, there's a great line by Upton Sinclair, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. Sure. And I would switch that to, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement and their luxuries depend on them not understanding it.
Absolutely.
And there was a study done in the UK a few years ago of youths, I think it was 18 to 25 or something. They asked them, if they had to get rid of one, which would they prefer, Wi-Fi or sunlight? And they overwhelmingly chose that they would rather get rid of sunlight.
That's like 90% of the ocean's fish are dying, and how many fish will it take before you care? And all of them. I'll never care.
Yeah, so I don't see... I mean, hell, we are in the shape we're in, and still... I mean, still, even most environmentalists care more for electricity than they do for birds.
Absolutely.
I mean,
I agree. I think the environmental movement has totally stuck itself. It's painted itself into a corner of luxuries. Are we inherently bad, though? Because I really love people. I think people are inherently, even in groups, I feel like we've been poisoned into thinking this for so long that we've lost the thread.
I completely agree with you. Okay, the reason I'm laughing is because I agree. I don't think humans are inherently evil. What I think we are, which makes me laugh, is I think we're inherently contentious. And yeah, I think birds are too. And I think bears are. I think everybody is. And probably trees are, for God's sake. I think we pick at each other. So people aren't fundamentally evil. I think that we're just fundamentally people. And unfortunately, in this case, we have got a system in which we are reliant for our very lives on destroying the planet. And I don't just mean reliant for our luxuries. At this point, there are so many humans on the planet, so many industrial humans on the planet, that, I mean, the planet can't support this many people. And it can't support this many people living industrial, especially. But having said that, a couple years ago, this is so important, because the thing I've been accused of for the longest time is, gosh, you want to kill 6 billion people. It's like, no, I actually don't. What I wish with every cell in my body, that we would recognize the situation we're in and start making reasonable decisions. I could solve overpopulation just like that with no draconian measures. It'd be very easy. Right now, 50% of the children in the world are not actively wanted, which means all you do is give women absolute reproductive freedom. Bingo, we're done. We just solved it. The problem is you're facing the Abrahamic religions, where men control women's reproductive rights and control their bodies. You're also facing capitalism's growth imperative, and you're facing civilization's growth imperative. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to happen. But don't blame me because I'm pointing out that we're in a pickle. Anyway, yeah. I asked years ago, I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, and also Vandana Shiva, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. Because people say, oh my God, the poor people in India, they need civilization. They both laughed at me. And they said, are you kidding? The people of India would be better off immediately if the global economy disappeared, because there are former granaries of India that now sell dog food and tulips to Europe. And there are people who are being driven off their land for cash crops all over the world. This is why
there have been huge protests there right now. Huge protests.
Absolutely.
Huge farmers protests.
And I said, yep. I said to Vandana, what about the people who live in Mumbai? You know, the people in the slums. She said, why do you think they live in slums? They don't live in slums because they want to. They live in slums because they were driven off their land. You want land reform? Stop the global economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the people are driven off their land for dams. They don't get the electricity. It's not for them. It's for industry.
Do you think that we're having a bit of a seismic shakeup in our geopolitical tapestry right now with what's going on? Are we in a stage where we're going to be able to reconfigure in any way, shape, or form what we've been doing? Do you see any cracks in the armor? Do you think that this is coming to a head in any real semblance? Because I feel like we're holding on to an illusion right now, and everybody's very aware of that fact. And on the other side of this is something different, whether it's this same thing that we've been doing for the last 100 years, but strengthened in a new way with new technologies as we drive ourselves into oblivion, or is there anything on the other side of the wall?
Well, here's the thing, and sorry to be such a downer, but society doesn't generally change dramatically overnight. I remember I was at Bioneers one time, and they're catchphrase was the shift is hitting the fan. And it's not really. That's not how social change really takes place. Social change takes place over changing stories. And years ago, I asked two different American Indians, Jeanette Armstrong and Linda Hogan, I asked them the same question, which is, how do people become indigenous? And they both gave me basically the same answer, which is, if you live in place long enough, Vine Deloria said basically the same thing, that if you live in place long enough, that your stories can come from the place itself. And Jeanette said that she thought that the hill people living in rural Appalachia, she said she thinks they're like, some of them might be like half indigenous because they've lived there for 200 years and they know the patterns of the animals. They know the patterns of the seasons. They know the patterns of the plants. It's getting to know it. I mean, I've lived here for 21 years and walked this forest just literally thousands or tens of thousands of times, and I'm still learning stuff. But my stories didn't come from here.
Right.
And
the Lac des Flambeaux Ojibwe, reading their creation myths and reading their myths in general, that was the huge takeaway, was every single one of these stories has to do with what that animal is, what that tree is, what that does, and it's all an encoding in language, in stories, of what your surroundings are.
Yep.
With yep. lessons interspersed.
Yep. So what I think will happen is that this culture will continue to make, at best, superficial changes. Look at its response to global warming, and look at its response to peak oil. Joseph Tainter writes about how when a society has made itself complex, by which he's not meaning the same thing you or I would. He means a lot of specialization. He doesn't mean, like, he means a lot of brands of toothpaste. He doesn't mean, complex relationships with the land. So if a society becomes a civilization, basically, and then it starts to collapse, whatever they perceived as making it grow is what they will do now in spades. So if what built your society was to make giant stone heads and your society starts to fail, well, we got to make more giant stone heads. If what made your society work was human sacrifice, you need to do more of that. If what made your society work was technology and economic growth, you got to do more of that. And so what I see is a playing out of that until the bitter end. And by bitter end, I mean bitter mainly for non-humans. And I see it ending through ecological collapse. And then I see afterwards sort of Mad Max situation, so long as the gasoline remains. And then over time, over hundreds of years, if humans survive this, there will be some relocalization that will take place over hundreds of years. And some of these places that relocalize will be nasty because there'll be a continuation of Mad Max. Just like there were some indigenous people who were feared and hated by other indigenous people. You know, it's because they were sustainable does not mean they were necessarily nice. Some were nice. Some were really nice. Some are nice and some aren't. And there will be some who will eventually culturally and socially evolve into sustainable ways of life on grossly impoverished worlds. I don't know. The population of the county where I live prior to conquest was about half of what it is now because there were so many salmon. There's like 30,000 people in this county. There were like 15,200 years ago in this county, which is a lot. Anyway, so I think that any change is going to take a long time, which is why when people say, what should we do? I always say what we need to do. One of the most important things is to protect every wild place you can, to protect every wild being possible, but especially communities, protect wild communities. A question I once asked the head of a Department of Natural Resources in Washington State was, pretend we are children 200 years from now and convince us not to hate you. And I try to live my life so that the bears who are living now and the flying squirrels who are living now and the salmon who are living now and the humans who will be alive in 100 years don't hate me.
But we're talking about the Department of Natural Resources. When I came across Strangely Like War, my wife and I had moved to northern Wisconsin. Her grandparents had passed away. Here's access to acreage and forest. Start working with the Wisconsin version of the DNR. And everything that they wanted had to do with cutting down the forest in some capacity. If you want to join. Okay, so simultaneously is that. You know, I'm not ecologically stupid at the time either, but I'm not into forest management myself. Well, what's the first book that I found? Strangely Like War. That was like my canary in the coal mine for, okay, we're going to slow this process down and we're going to actually take it and put it in a completely different direction because that guy's going around the forest counting board feet when what you're reading parodies what's going on the outside and you have those synchronistic moments. He, you know, he's going around with his thumb, and if it's wider than my thumb, that means that it's X amount of board feet for this red pine, and that's a very nice stand of white pine over there, and that's a nice little grove of oak. And I'm just like, can you tell me what that plant is on the ground? No, I have no idea whatsoever. It's like, how can you be doing forest management when you don't know what is actually on the ground floor of the forest? Like, it's just, you know, blinders are up, and we live in this culture that we do this over specialization that leaves everything outside of it is just a blind spot.
So you don't have to answer this if you don't, but how much land are you on?
100 acres. We just try and keep it as much of what it is as possible. You know, we don't try and augment anything. We're trying to let it regrow itself. And I saw a documentary. I think it was Deep Blue, maybe was the name of it. It was this wonderful old woman. She was in her late 70s, early 80s, and still scuba diving and finding these pristine, you know, there's only a couple of pristine ocean spots in the world left. And she would go to these sanctuaries and try and she called them hope spots in the hopes that if we just keep a couple of places as pristine as possible in another 150 years, we can spider web it back together again.
I want to end on something positive that has to do with that,
okay,
which is there are more than 450 dead zones in the oceans. That's not positive. One of them is recovered. And, this is rhetorical, but you can answer. Do you know how it recovered?
How did it recover?
It was one of the biggest and worst in the world in the Black Sea off the coast of the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed in late 80s, early 90s, it was no longer economically feasible to do industrial agriculture along the coastline. It only took 10 to 15 years for that dead zone to disappear. and to have the fish come back so much, this part isn't good, but so much that they now have a commercial fishery there.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that life wants to live, and if you don't push it too far, I am not one of those people who says, oh, the earth's going to be fine. I think that is a horrible attitude, because if anybody you love was being tortured and killed, you wouldn't say, oh, they're going to be fine. If all your family members were being tortured and killed, I wouldn't say, they'll be fine. You got some relatives in Ohio. Anyway, so I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is, if you don't push it too far, I think if humans stopped, if humans got rid of dams, stopped deforestation, stopped commercial fishing, stopped the murder of the oceans, that salmon would actually be fine. I think they would come back like gangbusters. Because so often, all we have to do is let it alone. Mm-hmm. And that's what it does. We don't need to manage it. But I think in general, you know, the forest there, it knows way, way, way better than you or I do how to take care of itself.
And there you have it, Derek Jensen. I'd like to thank Derek for being on this week's episode. And I'd like to close the episode with reading a favorite quotation of mine, of his. Quote, "It's no wonder we don't defend the land where we live. We don't live here. We live in television programs and movies and books and with celebrities and in heaven and by rules and laws and abstractions created by people far away. And we live anywhere and everywhere except in our particular bodies on this particular land at this particular moment in these particular circumstances." Join me next week as I explore gerrymandering in the state of Wisconsin. And until then, thank you so much for listening and have a great week.